Good evening, everyone. Hello. Welcome. Hi, welcome to Neue Haus for those who haven't been here, and welcome back to those who are members. My name is Julie Solovyova. I'm the Director of Cultural Programming here. I'm really excited to welcome you for this really incredible conversation tonight. We are a creative workspace and a community that brings together people to talk about topics of importance in cultural and political space. And tonight, it brings me great honor to welcome a nonprofit organization that Kari Lazar-White had founded in 1995 that's been dedicated to social justice and developing youth communities for over 20 years in conversation with Carrie Mae Weems. And to speak a little bit more about what the organization does and the context of the conversation for this evening, I actually have the co-chair of the board of the organization Brotherhood and Sister Soul, Clara Markowitz, to introduce. Thank you. Welcome and stay for the drinks.
Hi. Thank you all so much for coming. We're so happy to have you. I'm Clara Markowitz, co-chair of the board of the Brotherhood Sister Soul. Welcome. We're so happy to have this event in partnership with Neue Haus as part of a series of salons we're hosting to talk about what we feel are important conversations to be having at this time. As many of you know, Brotherhood Sister Soul is an incredible youth organization located up in Harlem that offers holistic wraparound services to thousands of kids, young people in our city. And it's also a social justice organization, and they train youth workers all around the country. Of the many things Brotherhood Sister Soul does, including arts education, environmental education, college prep, training youth to be community organizers, month-long international study programs in Africa and Latin America, and serving over 12,000 nutritious meals to our city's children, and supporting youth in developing a moral and ethical code, BROSIS always encourages its members, alumni, staff, and board to use their voice to speak out against injustice and inequality. Much of the work the young people do, this call for more justice and equality, is done through the arts. So tonight, we'll be hearing from Kari Lazar-White, the founder and ED of Brotherhood Sister Soul, and one of the leading visual artists of our time, Carrie Mae Weems, as they share their thoughts on the power of activism through art. As many of you know, Carrie Mae Weems is considered one of the most influential contemporary American artists. In her career, she has investigated family relationships, cultural identity, sexism, class, political systems, and the consequences of power through photographs, text, fabric, audio, digital images, installation, and video. Carrie Mae Weems' work is represented in public and private collections around the world, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Guggenheim in MoMA in New York City, the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, the Museum of Contemporary Art in LA, and the Tate Modern in London. A MacArthur Genius Award recipient, she has received awards from the National Endowment of the Arts, the U.S. Department of State, the Tiffany Awards, BET, ICP, Harvard University, and the Guggenheim. In the New York Times review of her Guggenheim retrospective, the Times wrote, quote, "Miss Weems is what she has always been, a superb image maker and a moral force, focused and irrepressible." And my good friend, Kari Lazar-White, who's a social entrepreneur, a novelist, an educator, an activist, and an attorney, in 1995, at the age of 21, Kari co-founded the Brotherhood Sister Soul. He speaks across the country and has appeared widely on national media sites from CNN to MSNBC. His essays have appeared in publications that include The Huffington Post, Nation Books, MSNBC, and NYU Press. In September of 2017, Seven Stories Press published his first novel, Passage, which is distributed by Penguin Random House, reviewed widely and named among best new fiction by the Wall Street Journal. The paperback edition was released in January 2019. Kari has received awards that include Oprah Winfrey's Angel Network Use Your Life Award, awards from the Ford Foundation and Brown University. He was one of only three men to be awarded by Black Girls Rock and received the National Recreation Foundation's Robert W. Crawford Achievement Prize, a National Guild for Community Arts Education Award, and a Resident Fellowship Award to the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center. So we're so pleased to be able to present the conversation this evening. Please welcome Kari Lazar-White and Carrie Mae Weems.
So, I mean, right? So you know, I've had, like, mentions in all kinds of publications, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, all that. But when my name appeared in Jet, I think the world called me on the phone. Nobody called me when it happened in, like, the New York Times. But, honey, when it appeared in Jet, it was like, girl, we're sitting up here eating dinner, and your name is in Jet? And you have arrived, my sister. Thank you for the invitation to join you and to be with my colleague and friend, and for all of you to come out in this amazingly cold weather. Thank you for being here. It means a great deal. Thank you for the invitation to join you.
Of course. We are so pleased to be talking with Kari this evening. We were fortunate to honor her 2 years ago at our Voices Gala, which is the Gala of the Brotherhood Sister Soul. And it was an incredible evening. She gave a spellbinding speech, as no one would be surprised to hear, and has continued to be involved in our work. She came to our brownstone and met our young people and our staff in Harlem and was really connected to the arts of the space. And so it's just been wonderful to connect with her and to be in conversation with her this evening as we talk about art and activism, the intersection of social justice and change and creativity, an issue that's so deep to both of our hearts. Kari mentions Jet, which is, I think, key, but what's also key is that Beyonce counts her among the people who inspires her art, has said that Lemonade was inspired by the work of Kari Mae Weems, and she's featured, I believe, on a poetry collection that's entitled There Are Things More Beautiful Than Beyonce, and the image is Kari Mae Weems. So I think that's kind of all that needs to be said this evening. So with that, we're done. Thank you all for coming. You know, I think if we start this conversation with Kari's words, it makes sense. And so we each have written a few questions to ask one another. Other than that, we'll be in conversation. What we hope is that you all feel like you're eavesdropping on a conversation in somebody's living room. But we have written a few questions, so you'll see us kind of briefly read, and other than that, we'll be in conversation. But I really wanted to start with her words to center us. Kari said once in an interview I read, "Despite the variety of my explorations, throughout it all, it has been my contention that my responsibility as an artist is to work, to sing for my supper, to make art beautiful and powerful that adds and reveals, to beautify the mess of a messy world, to heal the sick and feed the helpless, to shout bravely from the rooftops and storm barricaded doors and voice the specifics of our historic moment." To me, it's a call to action in these times. It's a call to action for art and for justice. And so my first question to you is about the Black body. You work, and so much of your current work now is about state violence against the Black body. I know that the case of Philando Castile in Minnesota, shot in his car by the police as his girlfriend filmed it and aired it on Facebook, affected so many of us. It was a seminal moment of the intersection of pain and Black state and Black violence against Black people. And the Black body has always been an object in this nation. It has been enslaved and codified, sold and marketed, sexualized. The greatest wealth in this nation in 1863 was the enslaved Black human body. It was what was of most value in this nation, and that was supported by the state. We know the prison system, which controls 2 million people, is one of the largest businesses in America. And so when we think about the line of the control of the Black body, and you think about that legacy, but then the current reality, how does that affect your art? How do we speak to that 400 years of history that continues today?
Well, is I think Amiri Baraka so poignantly phrased it, we are always negotiating the changing same. Mm-hmm. You know, that quote that you read, maybe I wrote that when I was about 22, 23 years old. So the focus of the work, the focus of my work, the focus of the drive, of the ambition, of the desire to unpack and to unravel and to negotiate the space has been continuous. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really change so much over time because the circumstance doesn't change so much over time. What I hope to do through the work, through the careful consideration, the careful observation, the careful unpacking, is to always ask of myself the deepest questions that I can possibly ask of myself and the deepest questions that therefore I can ask of my audience. What is the meaning of life? What does it matter? How do you measure a life? What's important? What's important about living? The desire to, you know, the greatest desire is to live. My greatest desire is to live without fear of compromising who I am and to be my authentic self in the best way that I can be that and to struggle endlessly to be that. And that is a human right. Mm-hmm. And so to that extent, I'm always thinking about that basic right that we have to express the profundity of our humanness outside of it being a black body, but a human body. My father used to say, don't call me black, don't call me, just call me a man. I'm just a man trying to live. Mm-hmm. And so while I recognize the implications of race and ethnicity on our bodies and the sort of ongoing persistent attack on our bodies, I'm also aware and my desire is to really locate and to bring to bear the essence of our humanness, to share that with our fellow human beings. And so I keep trying to mine that in whatever way I can. You know, I was reading something, and I asked you to print it out for me earlier, you know, this really wonderful work by James Baldwin, who wrote earlier, and I don't know, if for those of you who haven't read it, his essay on the price of the ticket and on the responsibility of artists, I think, is probably one of the most beautiful statements written in the 20th century. You know, that our job is to illuminate, is to provide some sort of illumination in all of the darkness, to be able to point to it, to highlight it, to shape it, to give it volume, to construct it. That's our job. And we do that in many, many different ways, and we all carry it in different ways. But ultimately, we're really talking about the essence of illumination, that's the job of the artist, whether you are a singer, dancer, poet, photographer, visual artist, lecturer, writer, it doesn't matter. That is the job, to get at the essence of our humanness and to reveal the complexity of that in all of its shading. And that motivates me endlessly, that desire to get at that deeper question of who we are as human beings and who I am and who I am, first and foremost, mm-hmm. as a body. Because really, that's really the only thing you can really talk about, because that's really the only thing that you really know, right? Is this essence and how to project out of it. And through that comes all kinds of fascinating discovery and warmth and complexity and interest and dynamism and grace and power, and it carries us.
And that reminds me of, it was a kind of key moment in the union organizing space, and Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1912, the Bread and Roses Strike, as it was called. And this was a group of immigrant women from probably 15 to 20 different countries who went out on strike for rights, for more money, for a different life. But it's what dawned this concept of bread and roses, that one needs sustenance for one's body and sustenance for one's spirit. And that, to your point, that it's actually a human right, that you should have beauty in your life, that that is not something that is to be kept only in the walls of a museum or only for the wealthy or the elite, but that art and beauty comes from all spaces and must be celebrated and accessible for all spaces because it's the essence of humanity. Yeah. And I was always struck by that because in a time that women were protesting for food to feed their children and to support their families, it was also focused on, we also need this beauty. We need these roses in our life because one without the other, it doesn't work. It's not a life worth living. Right. So it reminds me of that.
Well, you know, think about, you know, the as you were speaking, I was thinking about, my husband gave me for Christmas a wonderful print by the great artist, Loretta Pidway. Loretta Pidway was one of the G's Bin quilters. And for those of you who don't know the G's Bin quilters, you are missing out. These sisters who lived on this little river in Alabama who've made some of the greatest contemporary art of our lives, who were all of them, primarily all of them, many of the people living on the island named Pitway because they were all a part of the same plantation. And so knowing who your siblings were, knowing your extended family was absolutely essential because you all had the same name, right? So that you could avoid incest, that you could avoid those sort of patterns of destruction. But they made just extraordinary things. And I remember as I went through when I first discovered or the G's Bin quilters going through their material, and every time there was one that absolutely rooted me to the spot. I mean, like, rooted me, you know, to the point that I, you know, that all I could do was weep, was the work of Loretta Pidway. Like a phenomenal, phenomenal artist. And so I thought, I just need to go kiss her hand. I need to go thank her for the contribution that she's made. And so I got my little behind in a car and drove and drove and drove, and all kinds of magical things happened. And before I knew it, 48 hours later, I was standing in Loretta's living room saying, thank you, my sister, for the magic that you've given me. And it continues to inform, I think, these artists continue to inform us. The quilt makers continue to inform us, I think, in really important ways. That on the one hand, yes, it was all about warmth. How do we keep warm in this place during the winter? Mm-hmm. But clearly, they were on to something that was deeper than warmth in terms of the pattern, in terms of the influence, in terms of the history that they carried with them, in them, that allowed them to create such extraordinary things of beauty. And so when I look at our particular cultural utterance, I am simply overwhelmed. The last few years, not months, but really years, I've been listening often to Louis Armstrong and this extraordinary sound, like no other, like no other. And you know that the music is not only unique and powerful and glorious and graceful, but it also comes from something that is much larger than himself. And so that brings me to this idea of the working of the spirit, in the flash of the spirit, in the making and the production of our work, the way in which struggle, personal struggle, social struggle, cultural struggle, ideological struggle, yields itself to extraordinary patterns of invention that simply can't be denied.
Right.
It just can't be denied.
Right.
And so to that end, I have a question for you. This idea of operating within the code of not only the notions of social justice that has led you to spend your life doing this kind of important work, but what is the role of the spirit and the role of invention that underscores the work that you are actually involved in?
So I think I'll start with Louis Armstrong and Satchmo. You know, I think history is so important as we talk about this intersection of, now you're saying, spirit and art and transformational change. I mean, you think about in this country, you can argue that the greatest American inventions of culture are jazz and the blues, gospel, created in black and brown hands throughout the South in unbelievably tough conditions. So you go back to Louis Armstrong singing, "What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue?" You go back to Ray Charles singing "America the Beautiful," which is a plaintive cry, not a song of celebration of America. And so today, when so many people newly seem conflicted with America, what does it mean to be an American today in this country at this time, with the grifter Carnival Barker in the White House that is there? How is one an American and also not an American? The answer to that, I think, is in Louis Armstrong's song. It's in Ray Charles's song. It's the conflict in life. And so when you ask me about spirit, for me, spirit drives my work because of the conflict, that there's so much happiness and joy in working with young people, in helping young people to transform their lives, to seek social justice, to become outspoken, to seek to change their own lives. But there's also a lot of pain in the work. There's pain for frontline workers dealing with young people, but there's pain that drove me to do that work. Che Guevara has that beautiful line where he says, "Revolutionaries are guided by feelings of love." And my co-founder, Jason, always, you know, speaks to that line. And I would always say to Jason, love and rage, right? Because the rage is real, too. The rage at the conditions, yes, and the anger. And so I think the spiritual allows you to process both of those feelings. You can't have love without the spirit. You can't process rage without the spirit. Rage is a very normal and healthy emotion. It's what do you do with the rage?
Absolutely.
And so for me, spirit, it drives that. And, you know, I think of, we have alumni of the organization, I think a couple of whom are here this evening, and they were young poets who needed an outlet for their voice. And they created their space. And then five of them went on to found something called the Peace Poets. And they are young men who traveled the world, 30 countries, using poetry as their tool to create peace and to build across lines. And while our organization was deeply involved in the effort to reform Stop and Frisk in this city, to end an unjustified racist policy that was in place and constituted 12 million stops during the Bloomberg years, every male at our organization,
12 million.
12 what? There was a comedian who said to reach that number, they had to import black people from Mars to stop them because there weren't enough here. And it meant that every single male at our organization was stopped and frisked, put down at the street on a gunpoint, all the male staff, myself included, going through that experience. And there was this powerful moment when we were talking about the numbers that were obviously unjustified on every level, that were unconstitutional and bigoted, but sometimes people would get lost in the 12 million stops. And there were these two incredible moments that came out of our young people. One was this young man, Nicholas Pert, who wrote his op-ed, "Why Is the NYPD After Me?" which was just a personal story of what did it feel like to have a gun put at the back of your head as you were stopped and frisked. And it transforms people's perspective. It, Mayor de Blasio said it changed his entire view on the issue. But the Peace Poets took the last words of Eric Gardner, "I Can't Breathe," and they turned it into a song that was sung throughout all the protests and all the organizing and all the marching, "We Can't Breathe." Mm-hmm. And it galvanized people. And at the end of the day, I think if you're seeking social change, you need songs, and you need dance, and you need music, and you never have one without the other. And so when I think of spirit, I think of spirit's intersection with love, with rage and also with the arts.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. First of all, I'm hope are any of the peace poets here tonight? You know,
a couple RSVP.
Yeah, because I'm looking for some poets. I need some poets. My new
we'll piece. Connect you to them and a couple
right, exactly.
others.
Exactly, you have to introduce me. But you know, there's something. This is very interesting because you know part of, you know, this sort of work that we're doing, you know, it's challenging, it's complex. Well, certainly I know that it is for me. You know, it keeps me up late at night and it gets me up early in the morning. You know, of how to do this work and how to do this work with a level of dignity. And also how to create the work in a way that brings you to the work.
Mm-hmm.
It brings you to the work, right? Because that's really, that becomes sort of like the challenge. How many visual artists are in the audience? Let me see, let me see, right? Visual artists, artists in general, just artists. Right? So there are a number of artists that are in the audience. Writers? Are there writers that are in the audience? Right? Okay. Right? I mean, to do the work, and of course, a part of doing the work is knowing when to get out of the way of the work so that the work can do the work that it needs to do. Right? You know, that the work needs to do something that is often, I think, larger than I, and that my sense of what I'm trying to do is to figure out how to, first of all, to make the work, to do the work, what the work needs to look like aesthetically, what it needs to sound like if I'm using audio, what the music is, what the visuals are, what the tone is. You know, I've worked on these projects called blue notes. What are blue notes and how to bend those notes so that it reverberates in a certain kind of way? But ultimately, if I want to have a deep conversation with my audience and with myself, then I need to bring a certain kind of nuance to the work in a way that allows you to get close to the work without repelling you, even when the work might be about you. It might be critical of us both. And one of the things that I'm interested in is a way in which I implicate myself in the work, right? That sometimes I'm an accomplice in my own victimization, and being able to claim that becomes really key to unlocking a certain way of working. How can I mark myself that I am you, you are me, I am participant, observer, and maker in this thing? I mean, for instance, we talk about black bodies and protest and resistance, and right? You know, I've been brutalized by black men. I've had a gun pointed at my head by black men, right? I've been violated by black men. And so for me then, it becomes not simply a matter of looking at, yes, absolutely, unpacking these ideas about state violence and that way in which state violence has targeted black male bodies, I think is absolutely critical, but also understanding how our own communities have been impacted and corrupted is also really essential. Right? How do we claim responsibility also for what's going on within our communities and mark that as well as a site to be unpacked and understood and discussed? That it's not all binary, right? And when it's not binary, then you have a mess. Mm-hmm. When you have a mess, then you have something to dig through, right? It's something that gets closer, I think, to the complexities of reality. And so no matter what and no matter how ugly, I'm always willing to look at the ugliness of the realities in which we find ourselves in contemporary capitalist societies and systems that deny us the fullness of our participation all the way around, and what that has meant and the ways in which that has corrupted the larger group and also the specific groups as well. So, you know, a lot of the work that I've been doing, for instance, in Syracuse, New York, you know, had to do with, you know, the killing of a young baby caught in the middle of gang violence. How do I negotiate that space as well. So I'm trying to do this work in many, many ways. But I have another question for you. You know, as a black woman, I, of course, you know, as a black woman, as a woman, you know, as a woman with a big mouth, you know, I face all kinds of challenges, all kinds of challenges. But I'm wondering, what are some of your greatest challenges right now in doing the kind of work that you're attempting to do?
Well, again, I'm going to start with something you said before the question. I mean, when I hear you talk about being the object of your art, a participant in your art, the creator of your art, obviously everybody's familiar with, you know, the iconic Kitchen Table series. And one of the things that always struck me about that series was the final images, or some of the final images, of you with a small girl looking at you as she puts on makeup, as you put on makeup, sitting around a table. And as the voyeur, as the watcher, I can only assume that that little girl also experienced in some way in the adjacent room or downstairs or upstairs some of the loss, some of the rage, some of the degradation, some of the pain that the woman image has experienced through the male who's initially visual in that series. And so what I'm struck by in that and how it connects to my work is that obviously these ultimate images of a girl and a woman are not just about the makeup or the image or the beauty. It's about passing on lessons of survival and endurance. It's about passing on lessons of standing on your own two and being a woman.
Traditions
and all of that. And so in our work, I think one of the great challenges is that we are helping young people define what it means to be men and women, leaders and brothers and sisters, to develop a moral and ethical code in a world that is profoundly immoral and unethical. We are trying to help children to learn to follow a different path than so often they see, to your exact point, not just in terms of what's happening in Washington, D.C., or war around the world, but in their very communities and sometimes in their very homes. There are times we are teaching young people to counter what they experience in their most intimate scenes in terms of their family. Mm-hmm. And it's a profound challenge of trying to get young people to take on a challenge that most adults have never taken on, of really defining what these things mean and choosing to live your life in a moral and righteous way. And so there's the very difficult challenge that happens in the home space. And that's why art is so important to us, because we think that young people need to have a creative outlet. They need to find their voice in whatever form it is. We need to speak out to be heard from. You know, young people are the least heard from, most discussed constituency in this country. It's young people who led the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the effort to create civil rights for gay and lesbian folk and brought down a president in Vietnam. And now all of a sudden you don't listen to young people, right? Martin King was 25 when he led the Montgomery bus boycott, right? The Freedom Riders were in their 18 and 19 years old, right? So where's the role of young people in our movements? But then there's the external. There's also the reality is here in this city, in the wealthiest city in the country, in the wealthiest county in this country, I mean, you're talking about capitalist structures. We have a county with the greatest disparity of wealth of anywhere in America, with the top 10% earning $860,000 a year or more, and the bottom 15% surviving on $9,000 or less. And so disproportionately, the young people we work with are coming from families where there is abject financial poverty. And I always say financial poverty because they don't have cultural poverty, they don't have familial poverty, but they have financial poverty. And so what does it mean to do this work in a city where there's that kind of wealth, that kind of segregation, that kind of inequality? And what you're essentially doing is asking people to support what these children should have by right, what these children should have because it is their human right, enough food and health care and good schools. But we have to do our work and ask for dollars because these children don't have what they deserve.
Right.
And so those two struggles, the very kind of intimate struggle of working with children every day on their own personal development, yet connected to these societal complex issues that only can be solved with the wider community. And that juxtaposition of doing the internal and external work is a challenge that I don't see ending, but one we work on every single day.
I mean, you know,
know, the thing that you know, I know that, you know, from my husband, like, I'm really hard to wake up to every morning. Because I'm really always, because I'm always working, and I'm always trying to, I'm always thinking about this, I'm always working on it. And it gives me great pleasure and also great pain. Yeah. And yet I can't imagine living my life in any, I can't imagine living my life in any other way. I mean, I just can't imagine it. And it energizes me. It focuses me, you know. And I used to think that, you know, when I started working with young children, that that I was giving back and that it was, you know, the right thing to do, and that I was helping these young people be something more than perhaps they could be otherwise. And maybe that's true, but one of the greatest things that I learned was that they've helped me tremendously.
Yeah.
That they've changed my life. That who they are has taught me great, great, great lessons that had I not been working with them, I don't think that I would have learned.
That reminds me of another of our alumni, a woman named Elizabeth Acevedo, whose novel Poet X just won the National Book Award for young adult fiction. And she always said about Brotherhood Sister Soul that we don't save the lives of children, but we teach them the skills they need to save their own lives.
How many kids have you worked with over the years?
Thousands at this point.
Yeah.
We serve about 1,000 throughout the city.
Yeah.
And that's Brooklyn, Bronx, and Manhattan. We're not in Staten Island. I don't anticipate being there anytime soon. But I've been there 3 times in my life. I'm born and raised here. That was enough. No offense to anybody from Staten Island, but definitely not happening. I think it was in high school. I was playing basketball there.
Oh, you did?
And we went to change in the locker room, and they had graffiti on the wall that said, "This is Howard Beach." And I think that was sufficient for me not coming back to Staten Island. I was good at that point. But go ahead.
I mean, there is something about, you know, these sort of decisions that we make, sort of a path that we choose. And so, you know, we're in a city with, you know, millions of people, and millions of people, hundreds of thousands passing through every day. And we have the opportunity of impacting just to that. And so what I'm wondering is, what do you want? And this sort of extraordinary effort that is your life, the life that you've chosen to live through this moment, what is it directed toward, and what does it ultimately mean in relationship to what you want?
So we have big wants and small wants, and I have big wants and small wants in this area. I mean, to me, I feel blessed. You talk about how you wake up in the morning. It sounds like we wake up pretty similar in the morning. And I feel blessed to come from a family where organizing and activism and social change is essentially the politics and religion of my family. I come from a family where my father was involved in the civil rights movement and my mother in the women's movement. I come from a family where my grandfather was a socialist and communist and organizer who fought in Spain and was incarcerated for his beliefs due to fascism, yes, American fascism of the McCarthy era. I come from a family where my uncles on my father's side had guns just in case anybody came and thought about taking their property.
Our families were very much alike.
Very similar. We discussed this before. There were a lot of guns in the South. And, you know, my grandmother, as I told you before, was, you know, on a picket line in front of Woolworths in eastern North Carolina marching. She was had all her children by the age of 19. And so her children were 16 and 17 years old and marching, and she was in her early 30s. She made a decision to be nonviolent and march, and, you know, a little white boy came up and pulled some phlegm up from the back of his throat to spit on her as she marched, and she said, "Careful, sucker, we ain't all nonviolent." and he backed up in that moment. And so it's kind of an insight into my grandmother, who turned 95 this month. But, you know, how she raised the family. And so that kind of fortitude, but also understanding the history of this country, that this is a country that is profoundly unequal and always has been, that this is a country that was founded for land-owning wealthy white men only, and no women, and no people of color, and no Native Americans, and no black people. And so you know that America is this aspirational goal. So how do you do human rights work? How do you do civil rights work? How do you do work for young people to help them be free if you know the realities of this country, if you know the depth of racism and sexism and bigotry in this country? I think you have to be profoundly hopeful, but you also have to be steeled to know what it is that you're up against. And so when you ask me, what do I want? I want a country where everybody can be free and be safe, regardless of their gender or sexual orientation or race or ethnicity or religion, which is a far-off vision for this country. I want my children, the children of BroSys, to not be hungry, hungry for food, hungry for a good education, hungry for art. They should have an equal chance. And so do we achieve that in my life
but
or life
for it.
Brotherhood, sisters?
But you work
so,
for
I don't
it.
Know. But I think there's something key about doing it every single day.
You work for it.
And the history is that you know what it is that we've overcome before.
Right.
And so that doesn't mean we achieve it. But, yeah, that's the ultimate goal. That's right. What we want.
Right. Well, you know, there are a few things. One, I think that Marx said that freedom is the appreciation of necessity. And necessity is blind insofar as it's not understood. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, these ideas, these sort of, you know, incredible ideas of, you know, what are these ideas that we're sort of negotiating as ideas about social justice, ideas about equity, democracy, freedom, love, grace. You know, what are the, you know, like if I were to ask you, what is the meaning of grace? What is it? What is the meaning of love? Most of us would be hard pressed. Most of us would be right. There are volumes and volumes and volumes and lives spent around trying to sort of qualify, quantify your sort of deep aspirations, and yet they're aspirations. And I would imagine that, you know, to some extent that we are probably on the same page. There are probably spaces and places where we diverge. Mm-hmm. You know, we go in sort of, you know, our own separate ways. But there is something sort of core about the idea, the basic idea of having the right, the fundamental right to explore and the fundamental right to live, the fundamental right to food, housing, healthcare, I mean, like the fundamental rights, right? And where all of that leads us is for every generation, I think, to decide and to discern, but that we're all sort of incrementally crawling. As John Otterbridge, the great artist John Otterbridge said, that we are all crawling towards our deeper humanity, just crawling
right.
toward it. Right? And every day, you know, I wake up trying to figure out how to be the better person. It's like, Carrie, you really need to stop doing X. You know, I mean, I talk like a sailor for the most part, you know. It's like, you know, I mean, you're, you know, I mean, these ways and my own biases and my own prejudice and being aware, you know. And the one thing that I think that artists do, the one thing that I think that we can do, we don't always do, but that I think that artists can do, and some of the greatest artists have done, is to strip away the illusions and the delusions of our lives. You know, that a part of it is being able to look at yourself profoundly and deeply, and to look at all your mess and to claim it. Mm. You know, to be self-aware, to be self-critical. And that art gives us these sort of extraordinary platforms to understand the deeper recesses of ourselves, of our minds, and of our hearts. I mean, the greatest music, the greatest art that I've really encountered has always confronted me, not with the reality of it, but with the reality of myself.
Right.
Reality of myself. And I don't have to see myself in some, you know, is it black and therefore I see myself. I have to see myself in the wholeness of me, right? You know, the wholeness of me and the wholeness of all of my mess, that I can unpack. You know, I've started my day in a very sort of similar way for many years. I mean, finally for the first time in maybe, you know, 30 years, I sleep until about 6:30. And this is like great. You know, because for years I was up at, you know, more like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning because I come from that kind of farmer's family, but also because I suffer from great, you know, anxiety and because I like getting into my studio as early as possible to sort of wrestle with me. And then about 6 years ago, I started waking up every morning to a playlist. And I have this very particular playlist, and it starts with Don Pullen's Ode to Life. And then it moves to Stevie Wonder's Love's in Need of Love Today. Mm-hmm. And then it goes to Bob Marley's Could It Be Love?
Can you send me this playlist? I like it already.
You know? And then it goes to, you know, to Luther Vandross's Having a Party. And Sam Cooke's This Little Light of Mine. And We Are Climbing Jacob's Ladder by Sweet Honey and the Rock. And I listen to this music in the same order almost every single day that I'm in my studio. If I'm traveling with my computer, I try to tune in. And what it does for me is to open up an extraordinary space of freedom and habitation and understanding, right, and solitude and purpose and just raw purpose. The Ode to Life. Yeah. You know, it also has Come Sunday with the World Saxophone Quartet. And then I think it ends pretty much around Pharoah Saunders' Freedom. Okay. And it is really, I'll send it to you. And I was wondering what was on your playlist and what you listen to, because music really has saved my life. It anchors all of my stuff. I go to literature and film and literature as well and poetry, but music is the unspeakable and the unspoken, can be the unspoken, that anchors it in a very particular way. And I'm interested in the way in which these artists have also used their music as deep, extraordinary invention and extraordinary protest song, mm-hmm, right? Stevie Wonder's Love's in Need of Love Today is just one of the great, 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 great songs, right? You know, these great protest songs that are shaded in all kinds of ways, but ultimately that is what they deliver to us. And I'm wondering what you listen to and mm-hmm, what sort of moves you into your orbit.
Well, I agree. Music is definitely central to, it's like you have your theme music at different periods in your life. That's also why either playlists or controlling your music is so important. Last night I needed to mellow out. I was listening to Dennis Brown and Buju Banton on Pandora or something, Spotify, and then all of a sudden Taka Taka came on, and it just threw my entire mood. It just wasn't working anymore, and I told my dear friend about it. We both had a good laugh, but it doesn't work, right? You have to control your own sound as it's coming into your space. And so for me, you know, many of the artists that you mentioned, I grew up in this city in basically in the 80s, and, you know, hip-hop was my theme music. That's all we listened to. And I can, you know, list every great MC and argue to the end of the night who the best MCs are, and they disproportionately come from New York City. It's just a fact. Everybody has to agree to that. There's a couple other people I recognize in parts of the country, but New York is where it's at. And so then a couple, you know, couple guys today move into that space. You know, obviously, you know, Kendrick and, you know, people like that have kind of continued to move in into my ear in the hip-hop space. But I've definitely, as I've gotten older, moved from hip-hop as kind of my theme music. You know, reggae is absolutely essential to me, and roots reggae, and you've mentioned Bob, but it's, you know, Jacob Miller, and it's Peter Tosh, and it's Steel Pulse. But I also came up in a house where, you know, Aretha Franklin was played on Saturdays and Sundays, and you mentioned Sam Cooke, and, you know, you mentioned, you know, artists who were kind of the sound of my childhood, and people like Bob Dylan and the poetry that Bob Dylan represented, and taking on society, and that could also be powerful art, yes, and absolutely. The jazz of Miles and Coltrane. And in my novel, Miles and Coltrane move throughout the novel as a theme music, because there's something about the connection to kind of one's soul and one's spirit through the music. And so for me, music has always kind of run hand in hand with also storytelling. My mother is a brilliant storyteller and the author of 10 books. And my mother and father are here. Yep, they can wave there. There you go. They don't like being called down, but there they are.
I've been wanting to meet them.
She knows, yes. She'll meet them later. And so my mother's an incredible storyteller. My grandmother and my great uncle coming out of North Carolina, these incredible storytellers. You know, you sit down at their knee on Christmas Eve and you're not getting up for 2 hours because they're going to tell you every story from the beginning of time to now. And so it's this mixture of kind of music and of storytelling. But something you said earlier really connects to me of why I feel so drawn to storytelling and to music. You know, you talked about this kind of human drive to connect, to be free, to deal with, as you said, the mess. It's that I think that storytelling, sharing one story, has a revolutionary power. Yeah. You can tell this really small story from That's a right. really small village in the middle of nowhere and connect to people around the Absolutely. World. You can tell an experience that's completely foreign to That's yours right. and connect to your experience. That's right. the power of the written word or the oral tradition. And so I'm reminded of Toni Cade Bambara, who's a writer who I revere, and she said once, "Are you ready to heal?"
Toni Cade, yes.
"There's a whole lot of responsibility that comes with being whole." Mm. And so art is challenging because are you going to heal from whatever it is, the exterior demons or the interior demons? Are you going to take on that responsibility to heal? And I think a lot of artists, we use our art to heal, to tell the stories, to write our poetry, to make our music, to Yes. make our visual art so that we can heal. But with that comes a challenge. If you're going to heal, if you're going to tell your story, there's a responsibility that comes with being whole. And a lot of people, I think, don't want to take on that responsibility. And I think that's the brave side of artists who are committed to it.
You know, there's this idea that, you know, that there takes there's sort of profound courage to be an artist. Mm-hmm. You know, profound courage to sort of stand up to mm-hmm. self and to stand up to powerful forces that really sort of resist what it is that you have to do. It seems to me that, you know, I mean, there's a weird kind of sacrifice. You know, there's a kind of a sacrifice that artists make. There's a sacrifice that I feel that I've made over my life, good, bad, but sacrifices nonetheless, to figure out a way of being present, of being able to you know, there's an extraordinary amount of aloneness in thinking about the whole. Mm-hmm. You know, that what I need to do is to spend a great deal of time by myself in order to dig this stuff out. You know, not only to figure out like what it needs to be, how it needs to be, how it needs to be made. You know, you know, there's a great deal of trauma in the making of the process, mm-hmm. right? And in this, you know, there's something sort of paradoxical, really, about I think what really terrific artists give up, and a part of that has to do with in trying to be whole, giving up a part of yourself so that you can be more whole, so that the whole can be greater than the part. Right, I'm just the part. I'm just one part of a very complicated whole. Mm-hmm. Again, just trying to figure that process out, I think, is really quite complicated. And so I'll tell you this story.
Okay.
So I was working on a project called Grace Notes. And I've worked on it for a couple of years. The project started out of the killing of the Emmanuel Nine in Charleston, right? And so I'm contacted by the organizers, and they've commissioned me to do this project on the Emmanuel Nine. And I thought that, okay, I'm not going to do a project about the Emmanuel Nine, but I'm going to do a project that certainly has that at its core. And I was asking myself, I called it Grace Notes, Reflections for Now, and started working on it, you know, every day. And I performed it at Spoleto. And at the core of it was really the meaning of grace, which I had not come to terms with yet. Mm. Right? I presented the work, but I still hadn't come to terms with the meaning of grace. And so I called, you know, I performed it. I'm still working on it even after I performed it. I came home and I called a bunch of people and I asked them the meaning of grace. And I recorded all these conversations. What is grace? What is it? And I call my pastor, what is it? You know, I ask random people, what is it? Right? And I get these like pat answers. It didn't make any sense to me. That seemed weak. And I call my mother. Call my mother, last person I called. She answered the phone. She said, hey, baby. I said, Mama, what is grace? What does that mean? And I had a conversation with my mother that lasted for about, I don't know, maybe about an hour. Recorded the conversation. It was just a wonderful, wonderful scratching, right? Digging at this meaning. And she started talking about compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, true compassion and unmitigated and love and devotion, you know, and that even when someone was attempting to deny you your humanness, you still offered them an understanding of their own humanness and that compassion to give back to even those who despised you, who would rather see you dead, but you still nonetheless offered and understood and gave them and respected the bounds of their humanness. I mean, this conversation with my mother was amazing. This is my mother. And so I think about this and, you know, I'm writing and thinking and then Trump came into office. And I was struggling, really struggling as an artist to just come to terms with all of this and these meanings, these ideas and grace and love and compassion and unrequited love. And I went to sleep. It was an August night. And I went to sleep and I was tossing and turning. And then I had this dream. And I was standing by the seashore. And there was this gigantic wave, this enormous, this like a wave larger than anything I've ever hoped to see in my whole life was coming. This gigantic wave was coming, and I thought, oh my God, it was like a wall. It was coming, it was going to envelop us all, and I started running, and I thought I need to warn my friends and my family, and I was afraid, and I wanted to live, and I wanted my friends to live, and I started running and running and running and running and running, and then I looked towards my right, and there was Trump leering at me. And I run past Trump, and I'm calling out, that a tsunami is coming. A tsunami is coming, a tsunami is coming, a tsunami is coming. We've got to get to higher ground. And then I see Martin Puryear's Great Ladder. Martin Puryear's Great Ladder, and all of my family and my friends and my colleagues were climbing this ladder, singing, "We are climbing Jacob's ladder." And not as a hymn, but as a protest song, right? You know, "We are climbing." It was unbelievable. And I wake up out of this dream. I wake up out of this dream. And I run outside into the night, and I stood crying for I don't know how long, right? That's where we are. That in the midst of all of this, in the midst of this profound tyranny, this unraveling of democracy that we are experiencing in extraordinary ways in this country, that many of us are seeking higher ground, and that we can seek that higher ground. We are seeking that higher ground, and that we will do it through our art, and through our organizing, and through our decency, and through our humanity, and through our work, and through our purpose to seek a higher ground and project something that starts to dig closer to all those things I believe that we want and we deserve if we are to be a great America, complex in all of its wonder and in all of its browning, as we sort of move into the next part of this century.
Well, first, that's an incredible dream. but, you know, I could talk to Carrie all evening. We can't talk all evening.
And so, incredible. Thank you.
We're going to have to move to a few questions to close the evening, but I want to respond to kind of a closing thought to what you just said. I mean, I think the image of your dream, to stay with that as a vision and a dream, the power to me of the ladder, of Jacob's ladder, is that it actually takes action. That when people talk about the inhumanity, and Carrie and I were talking downstairs about what it means to be an artist in this time and not wanting to focus your art or your reflection on Trump and all that he represents because you want to create, and yet having a responsibility to be a part of the resistance to what is occurring in this country, and yet to understand the history that he is emblematic of what has been here since the beginning of this country and is not the dawning of it. He is nothing new. We have seen, quite honestly, worse and overcome them, and we will overcome him. But that also love is not sufficient, that the action of your dream of climbing the ladder, you know, when you're talking about black folk shot down in a church in South Carolina as they pray, when you talk about Jewish folk shot down in a synagogue while they pray in Pittsburgh, when you talk about children in cages on the border, when you talk about a man who demonizes Muslims and Mexicans and immigrants, when you talk about our whole beautiful humanity and society being attacked, that yes, love, but also art and action and work and activism and climbing the ladder. And that I think that is a challenge to all of us as artists in this time to figure out in what way, how we are a part of a resistance to what is occurring in our country, yet also forcing ourselves back to this idea of Tony Cade's of, are you ready to do the work, to realize the only way we can really fight this time and this movement is to understand what he is emblematic of, what he is a growth from, and that it is not something unique, but it is as American as the beauty and diversity of what we are today, you know?
I mean, you know, and I think that you're absolutely right, and I think that there's something that the other thing that I think is really key is that I want something. I want something, right? I want to feel something, and you know, it has nothing to do, right? I want more, and I've always wanted more than has been offered. Mm-hmm. Right? I simply want more, and I want everybody I know to have more. Right? And that is and it's not like more stuff.
You know? Mm-hmm. I don't need, like, you know, another coat. You know, I mean, more, really more. And so the thing that really interests me is in getting not towards any system of things. We you know, understanding systems, I think, is absolutely crucial. What kind of system are we living under? What kind of system are we interested in? I mean, you know, sort of bourgeois democracy, mm-hmm. right? You know, the Democratic Party has failed for a long time, as has the right, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily, you know, that sort of binary thing that gets you any closer necessarily to the freedoms that I'm particularly interested in, right? There has to be something that's bigger, I think, that I am really sort of going toward. And I'm hoping that the work that I'm making, the work that I'm most interested in, tries to scratch at that. Right, of sort of paying attention to these systems and really trying to understand for myself, for my audience, for other artists, for other young people, right? What does any of this mean? At the end of the day, what does any of this mean? And have you, you know, like when I lay down, when I finally have to lay this body down, and give up the ghost, I want to know that I spent this time working towards something that was bigger and better than I, and that I deliver on that promise to the small extent that I could by sort of little incremental crawling towards my freedoms, that I do the best I could do under the situation and under the circumstances towards something that I think is profound and important and dynamic and powerfully human, that asks for and understood the power of transformation. Did I work toward that in some kind of way, or did I give up on myself? Did I give up on my folks? Did I give up on my friends? Did I give up on my people? And I mean that in the broadest mm-hmm. kind of way. And did I settle for the bullshit? Did I settle? And I don't want to close these eyes and say I settled. I think that my folks have just worked too hard for me to settle. That's right. I refuse.
That's right.
Peace.
Thank you. So with that, we have time for only a couple questions, and then there'll be a reception with drink and food folks can enjoy, but we just have time for a couple of questions, and questions, not speeches. Sure, I think, yep, it's Rashawn. I think there's a mic here.
Thank you. Actually, you just struck me just now when you were talking about wanting more. The thing that I kept thinking was depth, which brought me to this word vulnerability. And I'd love for you to speak to, you know, your vulnerability as you create your art and as you're going through the process, you know, sort of beginning to end, and how much of yourself you put into it. I know you talked a little bit about that earlier, but I'd love to know, you know, the anxieties and the fears and all that vulnerability that you feel as you go through the process, if you don't mind.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's like just, it's consistent, persistent, and always, right? You know, it's just endless. But there's something that's really sort of exciting about it. I mean, there's something very exciting about, you know, about making a work, right? And it just, you know, and again, you know, how to do it so that it has some sort of sense of truth in it, right? You know, that it has some sort of odor in it, you know? And so I'm just, I'm always quite upset. And just sort of, I'm constantly digging. It's just, I think, the nature of what we do. It's there's no other way around it. You just that's the process of this unpacking, unveiling, peeling back. It's just the nature of the work, you know. And the thing that's interesting is the moment when you
occasionally, because it only happens occasionally, when you know that you've done it. You know, that you really hit the nail on the head.
Right.
You know, and so I have to just tell you this very, very, very quickly. You know, I was reading, I do all these talks about influence, the nature of influence, and what you're influenced by, what you're paying attention to. And I do this around photography and literature and music. And I've been doing some reading about Armstrong recently. He's been on my mind for many, many years. But Louis Armstrong, this is interesting for anybody that's interested in the arts on any level or anything that's creative or magical or powerful. Louis Armstrong recorded St. Louis Blues 75 times.
Right.
75 times. He recorded it 75. He played it his entire life. Now, W.C. Handy, I think, wrote St. Louis Blues, I think. But he recorded it. So, or King Oliver. He recorded it 75 times. He did it at the beginning of his life, and then he recorded it through to the end of his life. Now, what was in St. Louis Blues? What was there that he needed to unpack, right? And every year or so, he would go back to it, and he'd say, no, I didn't do it right. I didn't do it right. I need to come back, you know, because if I add that, I know that I'm going to stretch it, right? And then he would come back to it again. If I add this, I'm going to take it. No. If I come back and I do that, then I'm going to, right? Over and over and over and over, that sort of careful mining of just one song over the course of a lifetime. And so I think that that's kind of a perfect analogy for, I think, really the life of artists, you who really are paying attention, that you come back to the work over and over and over. My projects, I think, are essentially the same. Right. It's the same project, and all I'm trying to do is to figure out at what point to enter this conversation now, from what angle, what dimension, to enter the conversation now. And so there's something I think is very exciting about that and also worrying about that. You know, there's that idea of worrying the line, right? A worrying the line of coming back to something and just popping at it again and again and enunciating and expanding and bending and twisting and making it absolutely and totally your own. And it fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, I remember as a child going to, you know, the museums of the city, Rashaan, and seeing visual artists and being struck always by the depth of paint. I was always drawn to those, mm-hmm. those paintings where you could see the thickness, the creation on the canvas, and always wondering what was, to Carrie's point, what was behind that 10th layer. What was the 9th layer? What was the 7th layer? What was the 1st layer? There was something passionate and living about the kind of thickness of paint on a canvas. And to me, that's also about that kind of process of creation and what it takes. You know, I'm not afraid of much, but I'm afraid of, terrified of losing people I love. And it was terrifying to put my novel out into the world. So for me to expose yourself in that way, a very different part, to put something creative out in the world for people to read, to judge, to react to not react to not respond to, it's a very different kind of part. And to take something that's so personal, I think all artists can connect to this, whether you're writing or painting or taking a photograph or practicing or recording a song 75 times, it's a deeply personal, insular, maybe a few other people if it's music that you're working with experience, and then all of a sudden, when you think it's ready, it's out in the world. And you lose, in a certain way, control of it in a way that you've controlled, to Carrie's point, every word. I mean, I remember the 57th proofread of my book and honing the words and every word and letter and being important to me.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it's out
gone.
There and you're
it's
done.
Gone. But you know, the thing that's fascinating is the ability to ask the question. You may not have the answer, but it's really important to ask the question, right? Like the project, the book, the work, it asks a certain kind of, it asks either a question or a set of questions that you are constantly mining. I'm fearful of not asking the right question. That's my fear, right? You know, did I ask the right question? Not did I answer the right question, but did I ask the right question? Because if you ask the right question, it can lead you through the course of your life in all ways, in all manners. And so that, I think, yeah, I remember, you know, being out way out in the country, in France. You know, I have like all these sort of, you know, bizarre habits. So I was looking at something and I saw this great rock. You know, I was in Paris. I saw this great rock that I thought I should go see, you know, like someplace down in the coast. So I rented a car, you know, I threw like, you know, a couple of, you know, a pair of panties in a bag and my toothbrush, and I just got in my car and I started driving towards the south of France or towards the coast of Brittany to see this rock, to see this rock. Now on the way, I'm listening, because I listen to music and lecture, I'm listening to this great, great, great lecture that Toni Morrison had given on freedom, the appreciation of freedom. It was wonderful. And I drive up to this sort of, you know, I have my like book, you know, have my like book, I have like my rock, I have the picture of the rock, you know, it's right there. And I'm looking at sunset, I'm looking for this rock, and I see this little man, this little Parisian, you know, standing out in this field. This field. It was a little beautiful little jacket, a little beautiful toupee, one of those things, beret. And I got out of my car, and I'm listening to Toni Morrison talking about freedom as I get out of my car. And I run through the field with my little photograph, and I asked the man, I said, I'm looking for this rock. Where can I find it? Where can I find this? And he looked at me, and he said, well, They're all around you. You know that idea that you don't see the forest for the trees? Mm-hmm. I had literally, in search of this rock that looked exactly like my photograph, I ran through a whole slew of them. And I'm not talking about like, you know, like, I'm talking about like rocks, monuments, right? I ran through a field of them through this man. And didn't see any of them until he said, but they're all around you. Mm. It was a profound, profound moment in my life. A perception of what you don't see, of what you're blind to, of following something so precisely that you overlook everything else in the world. Right? Because it doesn't fit necessarily with your imagined thing that you're searching for. Mm-hmm. It was really amazing. Amazing. Thank you. Let's go. Can we go home?
Last question.
Can we have cocktails?
Young person from Bro Sis, right here. Last question. We'll hear from her and then we'll move on.
Cocktails. I hope they have bite.
I actually have two questions.
Speak up.
One. I had two questions, but I only had to do one. So I was wondering, what advice do you have for a young poet like me? And also I'm in the Brotherhood and Sister Soul community. And I was wondering, for an advocate like you, how would your words inspire me to open up about what I've been through? And what advice do you have for me on sharing? Because I don't want to write something and write too much.
Oh, well, that's number one. That's not a problem. The thing that's interesting about the whole process, I think, of being an artist, being somebody who cares, right? You sit down and you write everything that you have to say. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to show me everything that you have to say, right? Some of what you have to say might belong to you, right? The only thing that you have to do is get it out of you, right? And some of it simply might belong to you, and some of it then might be shared. And so that becomes then a conversation that you have to have a little bit with yourself, right? These are all the things that I'm feeling, and some of these feelings are absolutely my own, and they're personal, that I don't need to share them, but I need to write them down. I need to express them. It's like your diary. I say many, many, many things that don't necessarily get shared with other people. But I think it's really important to get it all out of you, everything that you believe that you want to say. And then you start just making a decision about, I think I'm going to share this with a few people. These are some of the things that I want other people to know about. But that becomes something that you have to sort of work at, and I hope that you have some good mentors. I think that you have a few wonderful mentors around you to sort of help you make some of those decisions. But never keep it all inside. You have to put it all out there on the page or whatever form it is, and then you make the decision of how you want to edit and what you want to share with a larger audience. Okay? All right. All right.
So thank you all for joining us this evening. Thank you once again, Carrie, for being in conversation. Wine and cocktails in the rear.
Thank you so much. Good night, everyone. Good night, and Happy New Year.